Hey everybody, welcome to the PC Gamer Show. My name is Tom Marks, I'm the assistant editor here at PC Gamer. With me is James Davenport, our intern extraordinaire.
Hello.
Tyler Wilde, our executive editor.
Also hello.
And Evan Lottie, our editor-in-chief.
Hey there.
How you guys doing?
Good.
Great. Tyler and I have been working for like 9 days straight now, so
Oh, nice.
Things are great.
What's the record, out of curiosity, you think?
I don't know, 12 or something.
Oh, my goodness.
You know.
Well, we haven't quite hit that yet.
That's a lot of video
I guess by
games.
The end of the week, maybe.
Oof.
We got a great show for you today. Evan and Tyler, last time you talked about what you were looking forward to at PAX. This week we're talking about what you saw at PAX. In addition to that, Metal Gear Solid 5 came out today, which James and I are quite hyped on. And then we're going to also just take a moment to talk about... you have a Diamond Dogs shirt. I didn't even realize that. My God.
Branding.
Get it together, Tom. Synergy.
I know. I'm missing out on everything. Then we'll also be talking about Lawbreakers for a short amount of time, which is Cliffy B and Bosky Productions' new game. And finally, our regular Q&A with a Metal Gear Solid-themed quiz in the middle there to celebrate the release. But first, getting ahead of ourselves, what have you guys been playing recently? Evan, what'd you play outside of the PAX realm?
Outside of the past 4 days in which I've been getting my hands in everything possible?
Sleep is not a game, by the
so
way.
So in those brief hours of time between PAX and not PAX, I started playing Unity of Command again. This is a World War II strategy game where you play as either the Axis or the Soviet side. Released, I think, in 2011 or 2012. It's by this independent group out of Poland. Really, really, really good game. Turn-based strategy game. Hexagonal grid. Incredibly fun and incredibly easy to pick up. Great interface design. And it's very simple. Like, you're commanding, like, squads of infantry, and they... It tells you like what your success rate is going to be against another infantry before you attack. It's basically World War II Advance Wars, if you played that, like a beloved Nintendo strategy game. There's like a supply line mechanic, so there's a lot more nuance in there. It's not cartoony necessarily, but it has kind of a soft presentation, which I really like. So Unity of Command, if you like strategy, if you like World War II, it's very like rich in its history and its presentation of realistic battles and how they went. So... yeah, that's worth looking at.
That's funny. I haven't even heard of that game. I feel like a lot of strategy games nowadays will like just straight fly under the radar.
You can be forgiven, Tom, because literally 1,700 games have released on Steam so far this year.
Wow.
That's okay.
It's a scary number.
1,700.
Mm. Yeah, but Unity of Command was one of our favorites in recent memory.
Yeah. Yeah, Ken Levine liked it a lot. When I interviewed him for Bioshock Infinite way back when, I distinctly remember him bringing that up as like, that's what I'm playing and that's what I'm way into right now. That stuck with me. They're making a sequel. I think it's due next year. Cool. It's more 3D, less 2D. Anyway.
What about you, Tyler?
Well, aside from this crazy game called the PC Gamer CMS, the only game I actually have installed on my laptop when I travel is Civ 5 because, you know, it's a good game to play when you travel. And I've been listening to this podcast on the history of Rome. And that's been getting me interested in the idea of sort of... you know, every time I hear something historical, you know, I kind of... this is terrible because I guess my brain has been rewired. I, like, put it into the context of past, like, civilization games I've played. And, like, I was like, oh, that happened to me, too. That happened to Rome? That's cool. Because I had that same problem. So
what a coincidence.
I know.
Whoa.
So yeah, I've kind of been... poking around Civ. I keep starting and restarting because I want to kind of create a single city civilization, a city-state, you know, along the lines of Rome, just so I can listen to my podcast and simulate it. But, yeah, I didn't get very far at PAX because I was mostly using my laptop for running around and writing things.
Do you have either the Civ 5 expansions?
Yes, I have all the expansions and all the civs. I kept changing the civilization I was using to try to emulate Rome. But
well, one of my most dominating victories in Civ 5. I rarely complete Civ 5 games.
I almost never do.
Yeah, it's I get to a point where I'm just like, I want to explore a new world again. But One of my most dominating victories was with Venice, one of the expansion city or civs that you're only allowed to have one city.
Yeah, Venice.
And any
is cool.
city you take mm-hmm. over is a puppet state or a puppet city or gets just destroyed. And that was hilarious because you also, to like compensate for that, had just a ton more money and you could just buy out the world. And like anytime somebody went to war with you, you could just buy like hundreds of troops and it wouldn't even matter. What about you, James?
Oh, man. Well, in preparation for the Phantom Pain, I sort of went on a video game diet, you might say, because I know this one will be.
It's almost Thanksgiving yeah. dinner, and you're like, I'm not going to eat all day.
You got to slim down.
I was staring in the mirror, and my video game gut was just it was spilling over. So I took a break from a lot of games. I mean, I dabbled in Ground Zeroes just because I wanted to. You can import your save file, which gives you things. I don't really know exactly what. I think it's just soldiers for your mother base. We'll talk more about that.
Yeah.
But I also played the first, like, I don't know, say 20 minutes of King's Quest Episode 1 by The Odd Gentleman. Is that the developer? That's cool. It breaks away from... I was expecting it to be sort of full-on Telltale because that's, like, the successful formula. For a lot of like modern air quotes adventure games, but it kind of mixes up different kinds of game plan. There, there's like sort of a platforming segment of sorts, and there's like more puzzle solving than I've seen in a Telltale game, like in since The Walking Dead season 1, maybe like episode 2. So it's fun. I don't know how invested I'll be in the story because I've never played a King's Quest game before.
Yeah, I was going to ask. I haven't played. This is like. This is
you
a good
youngsters.
Sin.
Yeah. Get out of here.
It's before my time.
Well, there's this king, and he's got a quest he needs to go on.
Oh, tell me more.
Oh, it all makes sense now.
Yeah.
Imagine being stuck in a game and having zero recourse. Zero recourse to, like, what do you do?
I've heard about that.
Yeah.
I've heard that you
it's
can
really weird.
Get halfway through a game, and if you didn't pick up an item. You know, a couple hours back, you're done.
Nowhere to Google. Literally nowhere.
That's horrifying.
You ask your friend in fourth grade, and he's like, he tells you some rumor that's totally untrue.
Man. Yeah. I remember, like, when I would get stuck calling my dad over as if that was going to help with these kinds of games, because he would be even more lost and then just get mad at it.
But,
so, yeah. Do you think that means that, like, if you went back and played the original King's Quest games, they'd be a different experience now that you have this, like, font of knowledge at your fingertips? Like, do you think it would be better or worse off because of that?
I don't know. I mean, King's Quest games definitely, some of them definitely fall into that category of esoteric solutions to puzzles, you know? Or just, like, mm-hmm. why am I combining a feather with a... You know, with a piece of pudding or something. I don't know. Like, it makes no sense, but...
To make feather pudding.
Okay. Duh. Got it.
It's a delicacy, Evan.
Delicious. Mm. What have you been playing, Tom?
I've been playing... I've also been preparing a little bit for Phantom Pain, but mostly this weekend I went on a hard Terraria tear again. Mm. It was a game where before I... went on my week vacation, we were like about to enter, I was telling you guys, hard mode, right, where when you defeat the wall of flesh, it, which is, I'm not even gonna get into that, but when you defeat one boss, it makes everything in the game harder, and we finally did that, and then we went like into a little the progression of that, and it's funny because in basically what defeating this boss and going into hard mode does is it just says, okay, the progression of the game is reset. Like, when you get ready to prepare for this boss, you're killing everything in like a couple hits. You're completely invincible except to the bosses, which are still like the earlier bosses are just as easy as little enemies, but like that main boss is still difficult. And then you kill it and suddenly everything wants to kill you and everything is stronger than you and everything takes out a quarter of your life in a single hit. And this is just on like normal mode. There's also an expert mode, which makes everything harder now that they just added in the newest patch. And it's really crazy because then also you have to get these new resources, right? So like in classic crafting, mining, survival game fashion, the beginning resources are like copper, iron, silver, gold is like the progression of the best minerals. And then when you go into hard mode, those have long become obsolete. And now you have – the world gets all these three new minerals that are like even better than that, and you have to restart your progression basically from the beginning. And so it's this really interesting thing where you go into hard mode and suddenly it's just like the game is like, all right, you've gotten too strong. Here's everything more difficult. Like start over basically. But you have cool items and you have an idea of where you're going and stuff like that. It's fun, but it's also just like very – like I don't know of another game that does that in its progression where it's just like – you have a nice little curve, and then suddenly it's just like, boom, you suck again. And it's interesting.
Cool.
Let's move on from what we have been playing generally, and what did you guys see at PAX? Yeah. What did you like? What did you hate? All that jazz.
What a good show. I can't believe...
I think we'd agree that it's the most we've ever seen at a PAX. Hmm.
Definitely. And that's a little bit surprising because there are so few AAA things at PAX. I mean... at least as far as media was concerned, new AAA stuff. There was no real new AAA reveals at PAX. Battleborn was there. All the Ubisoft games are there. Siege, Assassin's Creed. But otherwise, I mean, Bethesda had a booth there, but they were only basically doing photo ops with actually this guy on our Doom cover. He had like a life-size demon that you could like grab a battle rifle and take photos with or whatever, but
because you know, who wouldn't want to?
Yeah. Yeah, true. So, but what was exciting about PAX this year, of course, was all the independent games being produced, all the surprising neat ideas being in production right now, kind of folding into that message I said at the beginning of, hey, there's been like 1700 games on Steam so far this year, and we saw a lot of cool stuff. I think one of the standouts for us, and we've got some great gameplay footage on our site right now. I think we can pull it up for those who are watching on stream. It's this game called Tharsis. Tharsis is basically Space Yahtzee meets FTL. And it's a somewhat realistic depiction of man's first trip to Mars in a space shuttle. Your first manned trip to Mars, I should say. And you encounter this like micrometeorite storm. Your ship gets really banged up, and the game plays out where you're managing this crew of astronauts, trying to make repairs, trying to get food out of your food production modules in the ship, and you're rolling dice to resolve all this stuff. And you have to use them very strategically in different slots, to either use like special abilities, or if you roll a two, the two might go into the void, quote unquote, and you lose that die, and you have to like manage the risk of re-rolling those dice against that. And it's a roguelike as well, so I think you have to survive or progress 10 rounds, and there are multiple endings. And I just love the presentation of it. It's very much a board game look, you know, like game. You throw these like sort of 3D virtual dice on screen. You can see all the little modules are some surprisingly good cutscenes that kind of intersperse everything. And this game just kind of came out of nowhere. There was a prototype at a previous PAX. Can't remember exactly which one, but. I'm a big fan of space exploration. I love to see games that explore that. It's doing so in a pretty grounded way, where like the actual problems you're encountering, they sourced from actual NASA manuals and NASA research, basically. And yeah, it's more roguelikes, more FTL style games. It's looking really, really good. And we walked away with a Steam key as well, so we're definitely going to be producing some more in-depth coverage on that this month.
Yeah, we talked a little about how grounded games right now are really interesting to us. There's no space wizards in this game. There's no aliens as far as I can tell. Yeah. Which is cool. I like that. I like games that don't feel the need to go into the surreal or the
supernatural
to sort of exist and express a story. Not that surreal supernatural games aren't also good.
I mean, our reality is pretty boring. We can't fly.
It's true.
But yeah, I mean, gosh, we can keep going on this for 40 minutes if we wanted to. We'll try and condense it and keep the hits going. But
well, it really does look. The interesting thing to me about it is that it really looks like kind of almost a different take on FTL's general like gameplay loop, right? Like FTL is like things are constantly breaking because you're getting shot or you're getting into unfavorable situations, and then it you try to survive, whereas this is just like everything's going wrong immediately and you try to survive. And of course, the gameplay seems drastically different. And it's funny because when I was in Arizona, I actually played a board game called damage report where you're rolling die and you're running around a spaceship trying to repair it in little bits and pieces cooperatively with a team. And it made me think, like, man, they really wanted this to, like, be a video game and decided to make it a board game instead. And now we see a game where it's like you're running around a spaceship repairing things as fast as you can.
Yeah.
So what else have you seen here?
Well, Tyler saw a really exciting game, exciting mech isometric game.
Yeah, and I saw Brigador, which we talked about a bit being interested in.
Yeah, this is one we mentioned on the show last week.
And I got to play it for a bit. It's tricky. You got to get the tank controls down. Tank controls, of course, where, you know, up is forward, not up. And deal with the fact that positioning really matters because you have more armor on the front, like tanks do. And then deal with the fact that the weapons, you know, it's a lot more complicated than something like Desert Strike, you know, a classic. Your weapons have arcs to them. You know, like a straight shooting bullet will still sort of move toward the ground, and you can't quite see exactly where it's going to go.
So there's bullet drop.
Essentially, yeah, and there's also arc weapons. Like I had also a my special for a while was this like smoke grenade that had an arc I could aim, and which would blind enemies. You also have close range attacks, and everything is destructible, so you can also use like big propane tanks to your advantage. And it's all a bit busy, and you know, it's all sprite based, but they've built this engine from scratch to sort of handle their height mapping and things like that. So really fun, really, really hard.
So you were excited about this game before PAX. Did it play like you thought it would? Did it handle like you thought it would, essentially?
Yeah. I mean, you could kind of tell looking at it, like, this isn't going to be easy. You see all these enemies sort of driving around, lighting you up, projectiles going everywhere. Yeah. I guess it felt like I sort of expected it would. I didn't really anticipate all the sort of interesting weapon combinations or the effects of the weapons, and also the ammo conservation aspect is pretty tricky. Like, I had these pretty cool rockets that would just shoot an incredible barrage as my primary weapon for a little while, and that was cool, but you could deplete the ammo in about, you know, 10 seconds on them. So, you know, using your secondary weapon to sort of hold off, you know, tanks that are coming toward you while sort of roving the map looking for ammo pickups was sort of a big part of that play. But they had quite a few weapons in there. I don't know off the top of my head how many combinations. And it sounds like the, you know, from talking to the devs, the focus is on, like, giving you a lot of choice up front. And as you go, actually letting you unlock more difficult weapons that aren't necessarily more powerful, but more skill shot weapons that feel really good to use. So giving you, as you learn your skills, rather than necessarily making you more powerful, giving you things to challenge yourself with. So it's pretty cool.
It's cool to see them make something like this with and make it difficult, which is what I'm hearing from you, without making it a bullet hell game. It doesn't seem like the screen is ever going to just be filled with lasers and projectiles that you have to dodge your way out of.
Yeah, it's not so much about dodging as it is just knowing when to retreat, getting into good positions, sort of setting up traps with your movement, getting sort of the AI to follow you in the way you want them to, using your special ability. There's one that made me invisible briefly. I didn't think it is pretty busy on screen, and some of the feedback was not great for me because so much is going on. At first, I couldn't tell that I was invisible or for how long I was going to. I also didn't have headphones on when I played, and I was on the PAX show floor, so I don't know how much information you get from sound.
That can be a big part of games like that, too.
Yeah, absolutely. No, cutting out the sound is cutting out, I don't know, I mean, arbitrarily a third of the game. Like, you lose a lot there. So I thought it was really cool, and yeah, I look forward to it. They had a lot of different areas, and it's all this just sort of hand-built sprite work that all can be destroyed in different ways, which is cool stuff. And it was cool to hear that they had been, like, you know, they wanted to do this specific game, and they, you know, programmed their engine from scratch to accomplish it, which, you know, I'm not saying you have to program everything from scratch to be a legit game. It's just you don't hear that very much anymore. You hear, yeah, we're on Unity, you know, or we're on Unreal or whatever.
So. Well, and those, it's because those tools have made it so accessible,
sure,
right?
Yeah.
So it when to me, when a game says, oh, we made our own engine specifically for this, it's usually because they had something in mind that they wanted to do with the game that, like, no engine could easily accommodate, right? So that, to like, you know, you can say, like, oh, it's, like, the elite, like, game makers and it's yuppie like that, but actually I think it represents something, like, it represents almost, like, an ambition within the developers to, like, make something a little bit outside of the range of those engines, at least to me. Maybe that's not the case. It's just that's what it says to me.
So what else did we say we're going to talk about?
Goodness. Yeah. Well, before we get to your favorite game of PAX,
yes,
we can talk about some. I played some Homefront.
Yeah, really curious.
Yeah, okay. Well, it was interesting. I didn't actually play the first one. it didn't get the best reviews. No. It wasn't the most well-loved game. So this is, you know, I mean, if you don't know the setup, it's occupied America. America's occupied by Korean forces in this sort of future reality that has fallen us. And in Homefront the Revolution, you're in Philadelphia, and there are three zones. There's the red zone, which is this heavily, you know, policed by military zone where you're not supposed to be, and that's where the rebel, you know, the rebel cause has sort of set up its camps. And then you have the more, you know, like the slum zone, and you have the city centers that kind of haven't been blown up and have been taken over by the new government. So the demo I played was in the red zone, so I'm avoiding patrols. I'm supposedly improvising to sort of move around between objectives. Movement seems to be the main sort of motivator. Like, you need to get here and activate this thing. And in between, there's sort of this procedural, you know, soldier activity that you have to get around. And it's not about blowing all through them. You know, you have to kind of hit them like a guerrilla soldier quickly and then get away, you know, while they're distracted. It was hard, and that's probably because partially or largely perhaps because it was a 15-minute demo and I hadn't been introduced smoothly to, like, all the tools. There was one point where I had this, you know, one of the tools you have is the standard remote control car with explosives on it that you drive up to people, which I think I've done a lot of times in games. But so I set it down. I see this patrol up ahead, and I'm like, I'm going to drive under their car and blow them up. I drive the car right up to their feet, and then I press the wrong button. So instead of detonating it, I back out. Yeah. And so now I'm just standing there looking at all these guards, and they're like, why did you drive this car up to us? And then they start shooting me, and I die running away from them. But you also have, like, a motorbike you can drive around. They actually said it was inspired by the Trials games, which I thought was strange, which is a 2D game where you're, like, dealing with. But they liked the sort of soft tires and kind of bouncy physics of that game. So that was actually pretty fun because I was, like, driving up ramps, and it's really forgiving. But, yeah, so I guess I didn't get, like, the greatest sense of what's going to make it different and interesting. It seemed pretty gloomy, and I don't know how much time I really want to spend in, like, occupied Philadelphia. Like, they had to, you know, one of the systems is basically like a GTA police level sort of thing where, you know, the first time you get spotted by a patrol, you get into a firefight with them. A you know, flying robot sort of Half-Life style comes up to you and starts scanning you. You try to destroy it. If it scans you, they call in more reinforcements. Eventually, you end up with an airship coming after you, which happened to me once, and I died. I died a few times. So, yeah, I don't know. It seemed stressful. I also had to play on a Xbox One controller, even though the demo was on PCs. I could see the PC, but the keyboard and mouse were hidden away somewhere. And the sensitivity on the analog stick was really high, and I'm not used to playing first-person shooters.
Excuses.
With a controller, so I think my experience was a little tainted by the fact that I just couldn't aim for crap.
Tyler, we expect you to ace those 15-minute PAX demos that you play.
No, I had the same experience when I played Assassin's Creed Syndicate. I was like, oh, man.
It's hard to be good at games at PAX.
Yeah.
So has anybody here played the first Homefront?
Yeah.
Some of it?
I did.
Because that game was one that really interested me.
I played the multiplayer.
And then it kind of came out to, and I never played it, but it came out to very mixed reviews. It was promising a lot of, like, being this very cinematic, movie-like experience at first, and then it, like, a lot of people just were not fond of it.
They sort of said the opposite here. They said all the sort of story should be developed, like, in-game while you're sort of in control of your...
Right, and okay, so that's what I mean is, like, they had, like, in at least the demo I had originally seen of that game back at, I can't remember what PAX, it had this arc where, like, you were always in control of the character, but, like, things were happening around you. And I guess when it actually came out, and this is all me doing hearsay, so I'm sorry for paraphrasing other people's opinions, but basically it felt like kind of an on-rails sort of thing, experience.
Well, that definitely doesn't seem to be what they're going for here. Definitely more open world, like...
I mean, I imagine a lot
of... point A to point B.
I imagine a lot of the sequels is intended to go back and try to fix some of the problems that people had with the first one.
Yeah, and when I played it way back in May or something, it sort of gave me like a City 17 vibe from Half-Life 2, of they're just guards kind of mingling and you have to deal with them. You're seeing their acts of oppression against the people, and you can choose to interrupt them arresting somebody questionably or not. And yeah, it's cool to see somebody kind of build on those ideas, I guess, because that's one of the best parts of Half-Life 2 for me.
And another... was modern military shooter turned future military shooter to a certain degree, right? Like, we're constantly seeing that nowadays. Okay, so what... I know... Do we want to get to what your favorite was?
Yeah.
So...
Let's do it.
This was a game that I played a long time ago, and
yes.
You can... I'm going to let you gush for a moment, if you would.
Sure. So, this is Warhammer End Times Vermintide. We recently did an article cataloging all the Warhammer games, and this is one of the most exciting ones by far. Our favorite game at PAX. It is a Left 4 Dead style four-player co-op melee and ranged weapon game set in the Warhammer Fantasy universe, and it's very much cribbing Left 4 Dead openly, and the developers are happy to tell you that they love that style of game and they revere it. And what... You know, I actually hadn't played it since January until it was, like, very, very pre-alpha, and they were, like, just putting certain levels in, and not all the character classes were in. Had a chance to play basically two full levels and a little bit more. And for one thing, what struck me was just how long it's been since I played a Left 4 Dead-style game. You could say something like Payday, Payday 2 folds into that a little bit, but I personally, it's a little bit different because of the focus on, you know, robbery and stuff thematically. But the melee, I mean, these are the same folks that made War of the Roses, if you played that game, War of the Vikings as well, Fat Shark way over in Sweden. They really have a good understanding of how to design melee in a game like this, and it doesn't feel compromised and doesn't feel too complex. It's not like you're mashing out weird intricate combos or something, but you know, with a given weapon you have a light attack and a heavy attack, and the decision to use that heavy attack and position yourself and the timing around it felt very deliberate in a lot of situations. I you know, you're getting swarmed by these enemies called the Skaven, which are basically their stand-in for zombies, but they behave very, very differently. You know, they'll talk to you, they'll kind of chirp at you and say stuff. They'll actually flee from you if you outnumber them. So they're kind of cowardly but intelligent. And yeah, just using that heavy attack, I was using a Warhammer at one point, and we're just getting surrounded. I'm trying to decide, you know, do I just light attack? Do I use right click to kind of push them away, or do I charge up and to try and sweep like six of them out of the way at once as my buddy's getting beat up on? And unlike Left 4 Dead, what's really exciting about this is you're going to be able to swap out your weapons and equipment. So it's not an RPG; it's very much a first-person action game, but you're going to be able to choose between like a sword and shield, and you're going to have more sort of block counters if you have a shield, right? Remember in Left 4 Dead where if you do the bash, you know, the right click to kind of knock enemies back. So depending on which weapon you use, you'll be able to do that more times. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So, and there's enemies that'll parry you. There's enemies that will, depending on which weapon you're using, say you're using a short sword, you can only damage them with a heavy attack because they're wearing armor. So there's a lot of good nuance there. They have their equivalent of the special infected in Left 4 Dead called Elite Skaven. So there are rats that will pounce on you. There are rats that will pull you away and helplessly. There are giant rats on steroids that will, you know, knock you away. There are There's a rattling gunner that has this like minigun that you have to flank.
Rattling.
Oh, yeah, I was going to say, you skipped over the name rattling gunner way too quickly.
It's pretty good.
How punny.
And he'll actually shoot other Skavens, so we can use him strategically. One of the ones that is distinct, other than the rattling gunner, from sort of the Left 4 Dead, Left 4 Dead 2 equivalents, is the Storm Vermin Patrol. Yeah, that's right. So imagine Spartan warriors, but they're rats, marching in formation through one of these streets, and they're super deadly. They're all really tough and durable. They take a lot of damage, but you can avoid them. You can hide from them as they march by. If you see them quickly enough, if you don't like cause enough noise, you can kind of sneak away from them. And we did this at one point. And then we threw like a barrel on the ground, and we waited for them to walk by it, and we detonated it and killed a few of them. So there are some unique aspects there. I think the loot system is going to be a big one. You're actually earning weapons and equipment as you play matches. You get like a loot dice roll, as they call it. And if you play on higher difficulties, you'll get more loot dice. And even stacking on top of this concept, there's a special item called a grimoire you can find in the environment that's like the gnome in Left 4 Dead, right? Remember the gnome?
Oh, yeah.
So the ceramic like lawn gnome you pick up and carry from one end of the level, there's an achievement associated with it.
Oh, yes.
And it just became this like emergent thing to do in Left 4 Dead, sort of a player-created challenge. So it's like that. You pick up this book, but it lowers your whole team's life capacity. But if you complete it, you complete a round with it, you get more loot dice. There's a higher chance for better loot. So I think that system's going to add a lot in giving you a better reason to keep playing the game. You know, I think once you played No Mercy 5 times in Left 4 Dead or Dead Air or something, it was like, okay, I can play it on higher difficulty, but I know how this is going to go. I know a smoker is probably going to attack me here. I know the crescendo events. I know the finale. But yeah, and the other thing is, I'm going to keep gushing because I really think this game is going to surprise some people. The world looks great. It's set in this city in the Warhammer universe that's really well known to Warhammer fans. I should say this, by the way, I'm not a Warhammer fantasy fan at all. Like, I have no affection for that universe. I played 40K back in the day, so I have an appreciation for what Games Workshop does. But it's in this city called Uber. I'm not sure how to pronounce it exactly. And it just, you know, everything's a little crooked. Like, it's designed by some terrible, like, clumsy architect. It's very much expressing that Warhammer non-generic fantasy where everything's a little disturbing, a little askew, you know, which I really enjoy. Yeah. In some of the levels, we'll see this giant green moon hovering in the sky, and kind of green lightning will strike and light up, you know, little pools in the environment and stuff like that. So I think they've really nailed the art direction. One of the levels is a sort of the rat undercity beneath the city, and you're sort of tunneling in there, and you get to sort of experience and see how they've designed that world and kind of where their home base is, and that's kind of exciting to blow apart and fight your way through. So really, really looking forward to this. It sort of makes you realize how few Left 4 Dead clones, right, quote unquote, there actually were.
Well, and that's an interesting point, because that's something we discussed when I got to play Vermintide back in an early version when Fat Shark came to the office one time. Was we were talking about how, like, why hasn't anybody ripped off Left 4 Dead? Like, and I use ripped off almost as like an affectionate term in this case, you know? Yeah. Like, because you brought up Payday, and Payday 2 is very much a like 4-player co-op against the AI experience. But I think the key thing that Vermintide and Left 4 Dead share is the linear like story.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, point A to point B.
Yeah. And that you're learning like more about the world as you're going through it a little bit. Obviously, Left 4 Dead's story was very shallow, but it was also a path you follow.
Do the characters have banter and conversations?
They do. There are 5 of them. One of them, actually, I forget exactly which ones. Oh, there's like a witch hunter character, I think is the class name. And then there is a bright wizard. And in the story of Vermintide, I guess the witch hunter, if I have this correct, has like arrested the Bright Wizard, and is like trying to take them to jail, or sorcerer jail, wizard jail, whatever it is.
Wizard jail.
But they get interrupted by this event where the Skaven are erupting, and the end times, which is sort of the apocalypse within Warhammer universe, is kicking off. And they're like, well, I was going to take you to jail, but I guess we have to fight through this now. And I think they have sort of angry banter at one another, which is fun. I'm going to say this real quick, too. The Bright Wizard, really cool class, interesting mechanics. So it's like a fire wizard, basically. But as you use your abilities, so I use a staff that has this basically a beam of fire that would just fire straight through the environment and light enemies on fire. There's an overheating mechanic where as you use it more, you cause yourself damage and you have to be careful. So that was kind of interesting and unique.
Anyone mentioned mod support, Evan?
Yeah, when I talked to them about it in January, and this is an important thing, right? Because Left 4 Dead 2, its longevity was in place because it had modding support, because there were so many great maps out there that, honestly, so many of them were better than the stock maps in the game, more creative, more kind of interesting and unexpected. I don't think they're planning on it at launch. I think it's something they're going to feel out. This is their most ambitious project by far, Fat Shark, so I think they're just focused on that, and I really hope it's possible for them. I'm not sure if they built the game to accommodate it.
Hopefully they have, because like you said, mod support always just makes a game survive, you know, years past its expiration date, essentially. But this is another game, too, that has committed the crime that we talked about last week a little bit of, like, why would you name your game that? Because it's Warhammer : The End Times -Vermintide.
Yeah, you need multiple types of punctuation.
Oh, no, excuse me, the other way around. Warhammer : Vermintide - The End Times.
No.
One of the two. Did I get it right the first time?
It's Warhammer End Times - Vermintide.
Correct.
But there's a colon between Warhammer and End Times. Okay.
Well, you had to first establish this is in the Warhammer universe, then you have to tell us when, and then you get the title of the game in.
Gotcha. And this is, I mean, we'll just be calling it Vermintide.
Just call it Vermintide.
Yeah. But for writing headlines, it makes it a hell of a time, man. You got an 80-character limit, and you're using up 50 on the name of the game.
There are so many Warhammer games coming out. I honestly struggle to tell you which are which. If you listed three of the four of the Warhammer game names coming out, I wouldn't be able to tell you which genre or which. I know Regicide is the one that is a chess game. That's I can tell you that.
Like that's an easy give on the name too.
Battle chess, yeah.
Yeah. I think we made that article, and I think it was something like 16 Warhammer games.
Sure.
Or something like that. Ooh.
They're just handing out licenses like they're tickets at a deli counter. Just all right, you want one? All right, you want some ham?
I think it's actually 12.
I got a co-op shooter for Fat Shark. Fat Shark. Hey.
Exactly.
And there's multiple of the same genre, too.
Could you have
shooter,
it open?
Sorry,
yeah, I do. I've pulled it open.
Call out like one of the names at random, and I'll try and guess. Okay. We'll try and guess what... This is sort of like our pre-game trivia segment now.
So we can't do Total War Warhammer. That's easy, right? That's another one of the givens.
Of course. Well, yeah. Of course.
Okay, let's do this one. Space Hulk Deathwing.
I mean, I know Space Hulk is originally a board game in the Games Workshop universe, so I guess it's like a turn-based strategy game. There was a Space Hulk game last year, I thought.
Yeah, but can't you say that about every Warhammer like thing? Is it was a strategy game at some point?
I'm gonna say it's a turn-based strategy game on a spaceship. You play as the Space Marines. I don't know.
So I think you got the Space Marines part right, but it's actually an FPS.
What?
Whoa.
Yeah.
There's a Space Hulk FPS?
Apparently there's
cool.
A Space Hulk FPS.
I guess. Yeah.
Let's see.
I mean, in a way, this is like us representing our job security, because we need to help you guys keep all these games straight.
Hire a Warhammer guy.
There's a Warhammer sports game. There's Blood Bowl 2.
I didn't even know that was Warhammer.
I
think it's just Games Workshop. It's like a sister brand or something.
Mm. Okay, Warhammer 40K Dark Nexus Arena.
Oh, no. That's got to be the MOBA. It says Arena.
Yeah.
It's the MOBA. And it's got the
good
word
call.
Nexus.
Good call. Nexus is a MOBA.
So many Nexuses.
Okay, this isn't as hard as I thought.
Yeah, we can do it.
And then let's do one more. Warhammer 40K Inquisitor Martyr.
That's like a third-person thing?
That's another colon name dash other name.
So we know how this works. You know, we've established Inquisitor has to do with the universe. Martyr is the name of the game. but that doesn't tell me anything.
That's such a strange subtitle.
A third person thing. I read about this.
That's the action RPG made by Neocore Games, which are the people that do Adventures of Van Helsing.
So Diablo style.
Yeah, kind of like that.
Okay.
What do you attribute to how many Warhammer games are coming out right now? Like, why is Games Workshop suddenly in just the last year just like throwing out their IP?
It's not by coincidence, whatever it is. I don't know enough about the company to really speculate. I guess they said this is part of our strategy. And I think one of the dangers is, of course, they could end up like the Star Wars games in the 90s, right? Where we're just making every possible Star Wars game we can, and then you develop this like pretty bad reputation. So
it's interesting. I feel like Warhammer is, you know, popular, you know, within a niche. It's not certainly not something I would call mainstream. It's something on the universe we find really interesting. Jody McGregor wrote for us about why their space marines are the best, because they friggin' eat people's brains and stuff.
Space marines apparently have two hearts, which in and of itself is very exciting, and all other kinds of organs, but chiefly among them, they have some sort of implanted gland called the Remembrancer, which allows them, which, great name, tattoo that on your body if you can. It allows you to retain the memories, I guess, of the brains that you eat, even if they're not even your own race. So it's really weird how they don't put this in the games, isn't it?
That'd be awesome.
It's strange.
So they have this sort of non-standard fantasy universe.
Yeah, they can also spit poison, by the way. Sorry.
Yeah, of course. They can spit poison.
Go read our article.
Which is really
Kojima
cool.
Kojima make these space marines?
I wouldn't say extremely well-known, the depth of the lore, you know. Commenters on our site do, because, you know, that's who we are. But, so they have, like, a lot of interesting stuff to explore that I think the wider PC gaming populace may not necessarily know is cool. So they have a lot to work with. I mean, yeah. If I were them, I almost would like maybe not even put the Warhammer title on everything and just be like,
for real,
this is a crazy weird action RPG. Oh, you know, Warhammer fans will know what universe it's in. Everyone else can just be introduced to it and fall in love with it and research it and find out, oh, exactly, there's more Warhammer stuff.
Okay. Like Space Marine.
Yeah.
I mean, it may be a requirement of Games Workshop to put the name in there. But anyway,
moving on.
It is a tragedy. It is a tragedy, I think, that they're not able to represent these weird aspects in the lore fully, because Space Marines have to be somehow American. You know, they have to they have to sort of evoke our actual military struggles, and they, you know,
blame
Starcraft. They can't spit acid.
Exactly, which is crazy. They have a gland that allows them to spit acid. I want to do that.
It's because StarCraft, like, popularized the video game Space Marine, right? And they had to have their acid-spitting units and their Space Marine units separate. Otherwise, it'd get confusing.
Those are exclusively Zerg.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, Tom, what's next?
So, Vermintide, you think, was your top at PAX.
Terrific.
Obviously, total, though, just a very, very full, very interesting, and sounds like a lot of fun PAX. I'll be avoiding you guys for the next week due to PAX Pox. James, you sitting next to me, also were missing a day yesterday because you were sick, not having been to PAX. So I think I'm the healthiest person in the room
right now.
We're
all going to be like writing the site in like little beds with white sheets with those sort of like cartoon ice packs on our head and thermometers.
I have two hearts, so I'm fine.
Yeah.
Well, moving on, let's transition into the next big thing we wanted to talk about. Metal Gear, but before we start before we start talking about that, we're going to be doing this week's Cat Fantastic.
Oh,
Cat Fantastic is our weekly quiz show, which I've officially just decided we're calling Cat Fantastic.
Great.
Confusion be damned. So this week, I decided to do, James and I put this together, so James knows the answers to these. So Evan and Tyler, this will be just for you, but in honor of Metal Gear coming out today and us being very hyped on it and the craziness is Hideo Kojima's storytelling, we've decided to do a Metal Gear Solid and Metal Gear in general themed Cat Fantastic.
This is going to be terrible.
It'll be great.
I can't do it.
So just for a real quick baseline, how many of the Metal Gear games have you guys played? Because this is a little bit unfair, because some of them have not come to PC.
Snake Eater. I've played Snake Eater.
Okay, so that's Metal Gear Solid 3.
Yeah, that's it.
I've played 1, 2, 3, And I started playing 4, and I got fed up with it, and I said, I'm done. I walked away from the franchise. I will be walking back into it, though, for 5.
Okay. So, for the record, to everyone at home and listening on the podcast or watching on Twitch or whatever, the following quiz segment will have spoilers from throughout the series and then the first half hour of 5. There's one question that pertains to 5, but it's just at the beginning. It's not really a spoiler. It's not really anything.
You're still safely in cutscene territory at that point.
Yeah,
sure.
It's the first hour and 20 of the game, basically, is an interactive cutscene.
Oh, boy.
So
never change, Hideo.
We'll talk about that when we get to Metal Gear. But so if you're nervous about spoilers, just mute the video or skip like 15 minutes or so ahead. But honestly, I don't think the spoilers are very bad. They're mostly for the old games. Don't worry about it, really. It's going to be a lot
without
of fun.
Context, like...
Yeah, without context, I'm not going to give you much context for these either. So the game is, without further ado, Cat Fantastic. True or false, did the following things actually happen in the Metal Gear Solid franchise? So I'm going to tell you an event or something the player had to do or something a villain did or something like that.
Great.
And you're going to have to tell me if that event actually happened in the series or if we just made it up. Now, we went through and we tried to pick out the craziest things that have ever happened so that we could then mix them in with crazy things that didn't.
Let's Lulele do this. I don't
deep
know.
Cut, deep pull
oh
there.
Oh, my God. Okay, so starting off, we'll start off easy here. The story arc of the entire Metal Gear series is spurred by the CIA trying to find the hidden treasure of a century-old secret organization.
God, it sounds plausible.
Yeah, I'll say true.
So,
I'll say false, just to be contrarian.
I have no idea which secret organization we're talking about—the Patriots or God, so many of them.
So, the Metal Gear Solid series. An entire national treasure kind of vibe going on is actually true. In Metal Gear Solid 3, they reveal that the Philosophers were an organization started in 1918, and they made this thing called the Philosopher's Legacy, which is this billions of dollar treasure in 1918, apparently, that has been passed along. And the first game in the series, Metal Gear Solid 3, is the CIA going into Russia looking for that. And that is what puts us on the whole arc of Hideo Kojima's wet dream. Number 2, because we have a few, so we'll move on. Your clothes are stolen, and you must take down and sneak by enemies while completely naked.
Oh, well, yes.
It's true, as Raiden in Metal Gear Solid 2.
There you go. That was a gimme, I think. That was a common one, but also freaking crazy, because you can do cartwheels while naked, which is
and
brilliant.
He never...
He's always cupping. He's cupping his crotch. It's really funny. Number 3. The President of the United States turns out to be a clone of Big Boss.
This also sounds plausible. I know clones are part of the story.
Mm-hmm. I think, it's what, Solidus Snake or Solidus is just his name? I don't know.
I'm going to go true.
It's one of your brothers, so to speak. Yeah.
Maybe it's not the president.
The Les Enfants Terrible or whatever it is.
Yeah, I'll just go true. I'm going to go true for all of them.
So that one is true as well. You nailed it. Metal Gear Solid 1, they reveal that Solidus Snake, the third clone of Big Boss and the only perfect clone of Big Boss, is actually the president is actually Solidus Snake in disguise. All right. At the end of one of the games, you find out the entire game was actually a dream.
I don't think that happened, unless it was in one of the like PSP releases or something. I'm going to say false.
The game was a dream.
Classic. Classic Kojima.
But that's something he would do. Likes the fourth wall.
He made a Nintendo DS game or Game Boy Advance game that used solar energy or had like a solar sensor on it. So this guy can.
You know what? Yeah, he can probably do better than it was all a dream. I'm going to go with Evan because he's doing well. Say false.
All right, that one was false, but it's important to point out that at the near the end of Metal Gear Solid 2, you find out that everything you've played up to that point was actually a simulation.
Yeah, that's what I was
preparing you for the mission at the end of the game. And there's a fan theory that all of Metal Gear Solid 2 was actually a dream, but it's kind of been disproven because the events in the game like are canon with the like the future games in the series. Mm-hmm. So it had to have happened, even though it like there's hints that it all might be fake. So that one was false.
All right, keep them coming.
A villain cuts off his limbs and attaches them to synthetic bodies, creating 5 sentient versions of himself.
Oh, gosh. I want to say, you know...
I'm saying true.
When I played Metal Gear Solid 5 at an event way back in June or something, I did encounter this enemy that was like 5 dudes in masks or something, and they seemed kind of... They seemed connected, like... In that way, so I'm gonna say true. I have no idea what the context was, but yes.
You said true as well, Tyler. I'm glad I tricked both of you because that one is false. I made that one up.
Well, I know because I know like limb severing is totally a thing with Revolver Ocelot.
Okay, so that was what I wanted to get you on. There is a character Revolver Ocelot, loses his arm, and then Liquid Snake dies,
yes.
And he attaches for whatever reason Liquid Snake's arm onto his body. And then Liquid Snake's arm takes control of his mind through that.
That's how anatomy works.
Yeah. Yep.
We're a little over halfway through. For anyone joining us, just to clarify and reiterate, we are doing true or false. Did the following things actually happen in the Metal Gear series? You can play along at home. Next up, a man stops a battleship that is sailing straight into a dock by standing in front of it and holding it back.
Who would do this? I'm going to say no. I don't know. Maybe one of the Metal Gear robots could do it, but not a man. Surely not.
Surely not a man.
This is too fantastical for Hideo Kojima.
I'll say true.
That one is true.
Yes.
At the near the end of Metal Gear Solid 4, and this one actually gets better, and I left some detail out because it sounded too like it had to be true if there was more detail in it. Raiden is trapped under rubble, cuts his own arm off to get out of the rubble.
Right.
Liquid Ocelot driving a battleship straight into a dock to crush Snake. He just... Raiden steps in front of the battleship and just holds it back, and that stops the entire ship from driving into the water.
He's a tough guy.
Yeah.
He's part cyborg.
They could have used him during Speed 2.
All right. 2 Metal Gears are created, a male and a female, which can reproduce with each other.
Are we having the talk, Tom?
The player must find and destroy both, then also their Metal Gear babies.
Metal Gear babies?
I'm imagining the cartoon children version of the Metal Gear series.
Oh, God.
Metal Gear babies. Little Metal Gear. They're all in school together.
Metal Gear Junior? Yeah.
I always thought the little robot that followed you around in the fourth one was a Metal Gear baby. Like, it looked so tiny, but apparently not.
I'm going to say false because I just want it to be false.
Yeah, I want that to be false,
you
too.
You just hope that that is not something that has happened.
Yeah.
That one is false.
Yes.
But... God. I have to say, I was pretty proud of that.
That's
I thought
a good
that,
one.
That could be potentially something that Kojima came up with.
It totally could be. Oh my God.
All right. And finally, a giant whale made of fire jumps into the sky, eats a helicopter, and then turns into a flaming unicorn with wings made of fire.
Come on, guys.
That's clearly true. I mean, not in the Metal Gear series. I saw that.
Oh, yes.
I'm going to say true.
I don't like how much I'm hesitating here, but like the last question, I'm going to say false. The transformation from one animal to another, either this is some sort of hallucination that I haven't seen in the Metal Gear series, just please be false, Tom.
That one is absolutely true. That actually, like I said, that was, this will be our transition into our conversation about Metal Gear Solid 5.
So the whale is composed of fire?
So this was, I didn't feel bad about spoiling this because this was actually in the first trailer ever released for Metal Gear Solid 5.
Yeah.
And it happens at the beginning of the game. And I was playing it last night.
Me too.
James and I, as soon as it went live, we started playing. And literally, this scene happened in the game. This kind of pyrotechno crazy girl summons this giant whale because she's getting shot at by a helicopter. The whale on fire comes up, eats the helicopter and then kind of dissipates, and out of it comes her riding a flaming Pegasus unicorn.
So hold on. I'm gonna stop you right there. The whale is in the water.
No. The whale jumps out of a burning building.
What? With a box of kittens that it saved.
Is it an actual whale?
Yes.
It's not a robot whale?
I can pull up the video.
It's not like a robotics simulacrum of a whale?
This is an actual... It's metaphysical. We're going to pull up into the trailer, and folks in podcasts, that's the crazy lady. This is an actual whale... actually on fire or made of flames.
Don't pretend you're at SeaWorld.
I'm not entirely sure which, but it eats...
Oh, my God. There it is.
It eats a helicopter, and then out of it comes a flaming unicorn with fiery wings.
Man.
This is actually a thing.
Hold on. That's a Pegasus, isn't it?
Well, it's
but back that up.
Okay, so this is the question. I was trying to figure this out. Pegasus doesn't have a horn, though.
Absolutely doesn't.
So flying unicorn is more the way it goes.
Tom.
Winged unicorn?
Your familiarity with Harry Potter rivals anyone in, like, the surrounding three counties.
I haven't even read past the third book.
What?
No.
What?
Okay. I just played Quidditch, man.
What? Life is a lie.
We'll get into this later.
But
the flaming whale is
so giant whale jumps
miraculous.
Out of a flaming building, eats a helicopter, turns into a unicorn, and then the best part after that is that immediately following that is a chase scene where you're on the back of a horse shooting at the flaming unicorn, which is running at you with a shotgun,
It
has a like fire demon on the back.
So like. I want to know what is the whale doing before it pounces?
Nothing. It just appears.
Is it sort of...
This is why this was so amazing.
No, I prefer the idea that she had to put it in there first to set all this up.
It's idling. Is it reading a magazine?
Oh, there he is. There he is. Go. Get the whale.
This was actually weeks of preparation.
The whale was briefed.
This is actually why this scene was so amazing, is because I was playing this and I literally out loud was just like, what the fuck is going on? And then I immediately went to the Google Doc and rewrote the end of the quiz because it had to be in there.
I'm glad you did.
It was so good.
Well, this is right at the center of what I love about the game. It's the franchise, its ability to really, and we don't even question it anymore. We just accept it. It's incredibly serious.
Mm-hmm.
Takes itself incredibly seriously in its sort of political, conspiratorial expression of, you know, all these weird theories and how everything's connected. It's so intricate and ridiculous.
Yeah.
And it has stuff like that. It has crazy supernatural mind reading characters and, you know, all this whimsy, pure whimsy, really pure humor and like comic relief. To soften that, you know, and it honestly works, I think, in a lot of cases. You know, as much as you can criticize different aspects of Metal Gear Solid 4, Metal Gear Solid 2, the ending like gets so bogged down in its plot explanation, you know, but those moments of whimsy and ridiculousness really do give it it's a personality unlike anything I think in gaming.
And James, you were talking earlier about how. In similar to what you were saying, this was one of the darkest beginnings to, or like darkest segments in a Metal game was the beginning of this game.
Yeah, you're totally correct, Evan, like in that the absurdity in past Metal Gear games kind of comes off as comic relief. And I mean, not all the time, but the way it presents itself, like sincerely. In this, I don't know if it's the art direction, the like fidelity, or what, but. It feels much more grounded. At the same time, because of that, when the crazy, surreal shit happens, it feels much more pronounced and almost like horrifying and less like whimsical. I don't know if you felt the same way. When the whale like ate the helicopter, I obviously was like, what the shit? You know, but for the most part, like that first hour and a half, and I wish I had more impressions of the game as a whole, but for the first hour and a half intro, I felt like unnerved and on edge because it's very, very violent and dark, and the themes are all very.
Wasn't the context that you're coming into the game as it starts like somehow Snake is recovering from a defeat or something?
Well, he at the end of Ground Zero,
it seemed like you've been bloodied. You know,
you're waking up from a coma. The first thing you hear is a David Bowie song, and you're first person looking around like. gaining focus on the
Let's
hospital.
Let's dance.
Not quite that David Bowie song.
Can one of you like explain to me the 13 different names for Big Boss? Because I'm so confused when people say Snake and what?
Old Boss.
So there's a couple boss. Different things. He starts out in Metal Gear Solid 3, the beginning of his like storyline, he's Naked Snake. That's his code name. And then
007.
At the end of that, he becomes Big Boss. And that's basically how he's known, but he's still referred to as Snake. Technically, in this game, his name is actually Punished Snake.
or Venom Snake.
Or Venom Snake, but that's kind of irrelevant. People all call him Snake or Big Boss.
It's a big theme throughout the entire series of sort of different forms, you know, different characters sort of pervading across different games in different forms. Yeah. It's sort of like the game exists as a series of generations, but the ideas and the concepts and the people. And they're almost resurrected. It's almost like a reincarnation thing across different games where there are, you know, there is a Psycho Mantis equivalent. There is a Vulcan Raven equivalent in most of the games.
Yeah, and that's, like I said, in the first half hour, you see like a Psycho Mantis lookalike. Maybe that has something to do with the actual Psycho Mantis. And the fire guy, people have said he's got like Volgan's jacket from Metal Gear Solid 3, and there's all this like recurring imagery and themes.
Yeah, it's all self-referential.
Yeah,
I feel like you like you got a message from the heavens, and you dug up a book, an old tome, and you're just trying to describe to me your new religion.
it's you know, there's a mysticism surrounding Metal Gear Solid that is not far from that kind of thing. There's a I don't know, spirituality around it.
So, I mean, aside from the tone, how are you guys feeling so far? Like, have you done anything outside the prologue yet?
Yeah.
Yeah, we're both actually at the exact same point in the game. We did the, like, hour 20, hour 30, like, basically just interactive cutscene. But, you know, it teaches you how to play the game, teaches you how to shoot, teaches you how to move, very basically. And the really interesting thing is this hour and 20 minutes is, like, on rails, right? You can't you don't really have any choice. Mm-hmm. It's very linear. And then it brings you to the first mission where it's saying you're trying to rescue your partner. And it puts you into the desert on a horse. And they say, here's how you use your binoculars. Here's how you ride your horse faster. Here is the marker on the map that you have to go to, but maybe you can find information elsewhere if you go somewhere else first. Bye.
Yeah.
And I mean, he literally just steps away and just lets you do whatever you want.
That's the mission I played when I visited Konami, too.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. And it was an incredible transition, for me at least, where it was like everything. Like, literally, there is a 20-minute segment of the opening thing where you can't walk because you've been in a coma and your legs don't work, and you just have to hold the forward thing. Like, you can't go left or right. You just have to hold forward on the joystick or on the keyboard, and you'll just inch forward, and then you fall down. And then you inch forward, and you fall down. And it's that for 20 minutes. And then they put you in the actual game, and it's just like, whatever. Go ahead.
Go. Good luck. Like, they don't even teach you how to use everything by that point.
No.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I found myself successful in
that
mission.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think in the first one, you're supposed to rescue your buddy, Kaz.
Yeah, Kazuhiro Miller.
Yeah. And what stood out to me immediately was not just like, okay, good luck, go. It's like the world is huge.
Mm-hmm.
And the way you can approach something is not akin to Metal Gear games of the past, which maybe will turn some people off because those were sort of like room-based.
Yeah, very focused, almost set pieces or dioramas where there may be multiple entry points, but even those are very narrow and focused.
Yeah. And here you find a lookout from like literally a mountain across the way.
You're in Afghanistan.
Yeah, and it's so beautiful. I love the environment.
But that lookout thing is important too, because it's not like Assassin's Creed where you climb up to a bell tower and you look around and it does a cinematic. They say find like you'll get like hints here and there, and Ocelot will be like, you might want to find some place high up to scout, and you have to just like look around and be like, oh, there's a hill. I'm gonna go stand on that. You know, it's not like a point of interest or anything.
It almost, I mean, you guys have played more than I have. I've only played that first mission and one or two of the side missions that follow. It's refreshing it makes you consider and sort of realize how homogenous a lot of those big sandbox action games have become in their structure, where there are collectibles and there are sort of scouting points that reveal certain things to you, and we're going to give you a stealth route, and we're going to give you a direct route, and we're going to give you a bonus objective, and, you know, Far Cry, you know, Ubisoft is the most guilty of this, to speak. Even if it's well crafted, it's so familiar over and over again across different franchises. Like Mad Max just came out today, for example. I think it has a lot of the same kind of concepts where you can run up in a balloon and it reveals certain parts of the map to you, or you can, you know, take territory control by knocking out a certain outpost. And I think obviously Kojima is a different styles of structure, and it's just refreshing to see that. I think their twist on it.
Yeah, absolutely. You don't feel bogged down. Like, typically when I play an open world game, I just immediately get stressed out. Yeah. And this, because there's so much to do. Like, I think of The Witcher 3, as much as I love that game, I look at that map and I'm like, oh my God, I'm never going to do this. And I somehow feel like I'm not getting everything out of the experience. And this, it's just like, you need to go here, do it, however many you do it is up to you. And there's no, like, at least from what I saw, the environments feel much more natural in that there's not, like, an obvious stealth way. You know, like, there's not a tunnel that just you have to find in the water. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, there are some ways that are, like, much easier than others. But none of it is obvious. It all depends on, like, how much time you're willing to scout and how much time.
Yeah, and it sounds like it's the difference between making exploration, putting game rules into it, where it's like you've unlocked a tower, and now you can see more of this, and there are more dots of things to do, and then, you know, creating a game around sort of exploration and movement. They seem like distinct things to me, and it sounds like this is the latter, which is cool. Like using the environment to your advantage rather than using it as a way to achieve achievable goals.
So I want to know. This was very not controversial, but it was a change. Kiefer Sutherland, playing the main character, of course, our beloved Snake, Torture Snake, Venom Snake, whatever his name is. It's a big change from David Hayter being the voice for the lifespan of the game. What's your guys' take on his performance so far?
So James might have a different opinion than me because he's played more Metal Gear games than me. I've only played 4 and a little bit of 1, basically. But I think that Kiefer Sutherland is a just objectively better voice actor than David Hayter.
Whoa.
I think that the performance he gives is more real, it's more believable, it's less, I gotta go save these people from a house over there. But, also, Snake talks way less in this game, and I hate it.
And
it's not even just in the field. Like, when you're in the field, he doesn't say anything, and Miller's kind of, or Ocelot's talking to you on the radio.
Are you mute at first? Is that right?
Not really. Very, very, very briefly, but not really. Sorry. It's not, like, you can't talk for the first, like, 10 minutes of the first cutscene or something like that when you're waking up from the coma. But then when you get into, like, the cutscenes of the game where, like, Kazuhiro Miller's, like, very clearly, like, war-torn and, like, wants revenge, and you just rescued him, and he's, like, delusional, and he's, like, talking about all this crazy stuff. And Snake is just silent the entire time, ranting at you.
Yeah, Kaz even, like, comes up to you and says, Snake, and grabs you by the face, and, like, he just, quiet. He has a monologue at him, basically. Yeah.
So when Kiefer Sutherland talks, I think he's great. I think he's Snake. I think he really does a good performance, and I think it's a much more believable than the one David Hayter do. I'm no disrespect to David Hayter, because I think that the voice he did, like, was one of the reasons that those games were amazing. Like, he really gave this awesome performance, but I think for the more, I guess, mature way that Kojima feels like he's telling the story.
It was a very video game voice.
Yeah, exactly.
And this is now the fidelity's a little higher. You feel like you need performance
capture. It would be very awkward. And,
that's exactly what I mean.
David Hayter would be a very awkward voice actor in this.
He's not the right voice for this Snake. But that being said, like, I just don't understand why they aren't using Kiefer Sutherland's voice more than they have been.
Cha-ching.
Well, he charges by the word.
That's fair.
No.
Yeah.
Yeah, I thought that was interesting. That was one of the criticisms I've heard, is that, like, where's all kind of the silly side banter? Where's that levity? Where's I guess there's much less of it, yeah?
The levity comes from when you knock a dude out and attach a balloon to him to send him back to your base. I did that. So another thing that is weird with this game is I feel like I'm always going to be missing something. I feel like I'm always not getting something, which is kind of stressful to me. Like, I was walking around the mother base. I was briefly in the mother base area, and I was walking around, and I told this to James earlier. I was like, I happened upon a rat, right, that was just walking around the base. And I was like, I wonder if I can shoot that rat, just like as a joke. And I shot it with a tranquilizer gun, and then it let me pick it up. And I was like, okay. And I picked up this rat, and then I went off to the next mission. It gave me like the mission recap of mother base screen, and it said that I had caught a gerbil. It gave me money for an animal rescue, and then it gave me a unique gerbil logo to customize my crest with. Like, that was just a rat walking around my base that I happened to be like, I'm gonna shoot that rat, right? Like, and that was a thing. That was an unlockable that now I have and James doesn't. And he has to go hunt for a rat and if he wants to get that. Or a gerbil, I guess.
I think you need to, like, just give yourself over to the fact that you won't know everything and won't... It's a Kojima game.
Yeah, I guess that's fair.
And
I'm anti-completionist. I'm totally with you.
There's going to be... And it's not even that. It's just going to be things you didn't even know you could do, like gameplay mechanics you didn't even know you could do, like, until hour 30, I would imagine. Because... Kojima likes just you have weird one-off, not even one-off, but like almost joke tools that actually have a real purpose, and joke mechanics that have like a real purpose, and you know, like shooting a gerbil
or the box in general.
The box, yeah,
just the cardboard box.
That stuff
the
will always be there,
box.
And I think it, you know, just grows in time.
I love that the box is something you have to research within Mother Base to just
the very first thing
to discover. It's on the tech tree, basically.
Yeah,
it's pretty funny.
Boy.
Real quick, last word on Phantom Pain is I want to be really clear when I think it's immediately. I've only played 2 hours, and I think it's an incredible game. It's just the controls work. It feels tight. I have a
on PC.
Yes, I have a
mouse and keyboard.
That's what I was going to say. Oh, I've been using a controller. I didn't like the keyboard controls very much, but I didn't think that they were unbearable. I mainly had a problem with the zoom, the scope. But it runs incredibly on a PC.
It's so pretty.
I don't know what your specs are. I have an i5 4760 and a GTX 760 graphics card, 8 gigs of RAM, and it runs swimmingly, mostly on high.
Wow.
It's really well optimized.
Yeah, we've got a story on the site.
Yeah,
examining some of that stuff as well as the graphical options, kind of giving our thumbs up on it.
It looks so good. My last word is I'm with Tom, and no matter what, I think I'll love it because there was like 6 Moby Dick references like in the first hour and a half.
Not including the flaming whale, or
including the flaming whale. Oh yeah.
Jeez.
The helicopter's called the Pequod, so.
And you're named your code name is Ahab when you first wake up, and when you die, if you die in the tutorial at the very beginning, your like partner is with you, goes Ahab, it's great. Moving on though, I want to talk briefly because we have you here, Evan, and you're our FPS guru, as we like to say.
Hi.
Lawbreakers. It got announced as a name. This is Bosky Production and Cliffy B's new game. We finally have gameplay of it, and we have more than just like, you know, this concept basically.
Yeah, it's a minute and 20 seconds or something of gameplay. I got a chance to talk with Cliff Blazinski at the start of PAX right after this gameplay video went up, and I think
there it is.
You know, they had done such a good job of not describing what the game is in their reveal earlier in the week that it still was a genuine surprise. And the stuff that stands out to me, some unique shooting mechanics. You can see a guy firing behind his back. That's something seemingly you'll be able to do with every ranged weapon, which is really exciting. And the grappling hook stuff is really interesting. It seems like that has a lot of freedom of attachment in terms of you can swing outside of the world and stuff like that, but I don't know. I mean, they've still revealed so little. Ultimately, they've only shown this one map. They've only shown little glimpses of, you know, they've been tweeting out like kill clips or frag videos on their Twitter account and stuff like that. So it's a bit unclear how the gravity mechanics work. I mean, that's kind of the crux of the game, that it is law versus breakers, and you're both breaking the law laws of gravity. Clever. That's the elevator pitch or whatever.
And for the benefit of our Twitch viewers, I grabbed a few of those Twitter videos so we can have a little more gameplay.
That's awesome.
First person as well.
That's great. Yeah, let's pull those up. I'll keep talking. So, yeah, definite sci-fi. I think it looks gorgeous. Is looking great on Unreal 4 there, but yeah, it remains to be seen exactly what sort of competitive game it is. I don't have a sense of what the objectives are, or if it's just straightforward team deathmatch. I know it's 5-on-5. Not exactly have a sense of how long the matches are and stuff like that. So the focus on melee is interesting. It seems like there's a good amount of variety there, and they're focused on different classes and stuff like that, but not truly whimsical weirdness that we're seeing in Overwatch, where it's kind of every kitchen sink approach to game design and character design. So yeah, it definitely seems like, also I'm encouraged that it doesn't seem like a game about movement per se, even to the extent that Unreal is about mobility and dodging, and every person has a double dash in that lateral dash you can make in an Unreal game, where you double tap A or D. It seems like there are some characters in there that, if you so choose, you can kind of just stay on the ground and fight like a traditional dude or dudette, which is kind of encouraging. So yeah, I think, like we talked about last week, though, this is a hyper competitive genre now. Holy smokes!
Yeah,
all the different competitive shooters in production, and I'm glad to see everybody kind of throwing their hat in the ring. But ultimately, one or two of these games isn't going to work out, isn't going to catch on. Tyler and I got a chance to play Battleborn at PAX. Has a cooperative element that we played. We were kind of underwhelmed by it. Didn't feel very original. Felt like Borderlands kind of reskinned and cast into a more
structured
multiplayer online persistent universe. So.
But Lawbreakers, excuse me, there's so many names. Lawbreakers actually, to me, when I saw it, I was pretty encouraged by how much it looked like a kind of classic arena shooter at its core. I think that's something that not a lot of other ones of those character-based multiplayer games are doing. Overwatch looks a lot more like objective-based, right?
Very much so.
Well, I guess almost entirely objective-based from what we've seen.
Yeah, so it's very much objective-based like TF2. There is a payload style mode in Overwatch called Payload.
No way.
It's almost identical, except there's like a turret on top of the cart that you're pushing, essentially. So yeah, but at the same time, Tom, I think there's a reason a lot of folks have moved away from the arena shooter type design. It's all very skill driven. There's a high skill ceiling, and there's low persistency. So I think two of the most interesting questions for Lawbreakers are, how are they going to navigate the free to play aspects? Obviously, when I talked to Cliff, he said we're not even at the point where we've really implemented the business model and what that's going to be like. Right. So is that stuff like with the progression of earning weapons or earning cosmetic gear going to get in the way of that kind of pure arena style gameplay, where it's all about getting the kill, all about fancy movement and fancy like memorable individual fights, and yeah, just how they handle that, and are they going to be able to tell an interesting story in this universe? I think this is one of the most important things that a multiplayer game can do to be successful. It sounds strange. But you look at TF2, it's been around for 8 years. The reason people have stuck with TF2, as much as they've patched it 500 times, it's gotten a lot of new stuff and new items, obviously, new modes. They've they added MVM. It's crazy. It's a guinea pig of a game. But it was the first multiplayer game to really tell an interesting story that people had emotional attachment with. And they told a lot of that outside of the game with comics and obviously the videos that they released. But it really added a lot. I mean, try to imagine TF2 without any of that. If they had just, here's content update number 34. It adds this weapon and this weapon. Instead, they made everything into this luxurious, like, spectacular event where there's a war going on between the demo man and the soldier, and pick a side and see who can kill who, and we're going to have a real-time kill counter. They've talked a little bit about Lawbreakers has, and the folks at Boss Key over on the East Coast have talked about how you're going to sort of have to pick a side, and there are sub-factions within the Law and the Breakers. And when I talked to Cliff a while ago, he's like, well, I want being part of one of those sub-factions to feel like you're following a sports team and you have a level of investment, and, well, this faction hates that faction, so if you're part of them, like, we have to fight. So it's an interesting idea, sort of building in that level of sort of loyalty into a group, and I really hope that they can explore that. But they have to. They have to do something other than be an arena shooter in 2015 and 2016. They have to.
And that's potentially – you talking about the sports teams and Cliffy talking about the sports teams as well is like – that's a really interesting idea, and that would get me kind of more into it. But also, like, the trailer, the original cinematic trailer that explained the world, like...
The moon has exploded.
Right, like, it was so stupid to me. Like, the world that they set up was, like, visually and, like, conceptually very appealing, but the lore that they used to get it there was so dumb.
Moon go boom.
Moon explodes. Gravity was never the same. Like, what is that? You know?
It feels like story for to justify their.
I just keep imagining like a senator or someone being like, "We passed a law," and then a bunch of guys, "Yeah, well, we're lawbreakers. We're gonna break that law, buddy."
I don't know. I don't think it's that bad. It's like there was a cataclysmic event that was not an apocalypse, but really changed the way society operated.
BTW, Cowboy Bebop.
And now there's kind of some anarchy out there. There's a feeling of martial law, and things are kind of extreme.
Yeah, I think I just need to see more of it, basically. Like, this is a game where the gameplay is interesting, but it's exactly like you said. The gameplay is not what's going to set it apart from all the other games, which have gameplay that looks interesting. Maybe. I like Dirty Bomb's gameplay. Overwatch's gameplay looks good to me. Like, all these things look nice.
I need to know, like Evan said, how the Zero-G works. Because, you know, I mean, is this – am I, like, shoving off of things? And how on earth does that work?
So in this one clip real quick, we'll pull back. This is actually Cliffy B in this clip. He kind of like swoops through the air without really like pushing off of something. And he like zooms around a corner. So I think it's not just
it's like we have compressed air that we can.
I'm not sure, but I don't think it's just kind of like the Ender's Game style of like pushing off stuff.
Well, I know that maybe not in all situations, but some weapons, I think, cause propulsion.
Right.
So as you fire, if you can basically reverse rocket jump, you can fire a rocket behind you to propel yourself forward. So I'm sure that'll play out in different ways. But yeah, exactly what it means and how it's implemented. Is it sort of location based where certain areas have low, high gravity, whatever? Can it be activated on abilities and stuff like that? Remains to be seen.
Well, let's close out with our usual Twitch chat Q&A. For those watching at home on Twitch Live, send us your questions in the chat. We'll try to pull them out. If you are a subscriber, we will definitely pull them out and answer them here today. If you're listening at home on iTunes or what have you on the podcast,
talk into your car and see if we answer your question.
It might happen.
We might.
Call out
Dream, I do believe in fairies. It might happen. Nobody got that
one?
You
do believe in flaming whales.
Yeah, that's the more accurate one. That's the modern day one.
Yes.
That whale, like, it was the greatest moment of that whole hour and a half opening.
It's definitely under tattoo consideration now.
A giant flaming whale. You have to get the helicopter being eaten in the tattoo, though.
That's actually the main food source of giant flaming whales is helicopters.
Oh, my God.
They consume a great deal of helicopters.
Now I'm just imagining David Attenborough narrating
population.
This. The giant whale stalks its prey.
Those helicopters breed like rabbits.
The hind D hovers. It may be loaded with a Vulcan minigun and rockets, but it has never been more vulnerable.
Planet Earth got weird. Yeah.
I want to also just real quickly emphasize how completely out of nowhere this whale was. It was not referenced before the moment it appeared. It was not referenced after the moment it appeared. It's just out of a burning building, flaming whale appears to eat the thing and then just vanishes.
There was Moby Dick stuff.
Snake says,
yeah. Right, but there was Moby Dick stuff, but I mean like not a whale
that
they set on
fire. No, it's not like they
were
getting chased by a whale the whole time. It was just like...
Oh my goodness. Let's see what we've got. Love to know if you can remove the Metal Gear Solid 5 FPS cap in the config file. I don't know if you can, but I also want to point out that it runs, I think it's capped at 60 right now, and for me it hit that incredibly well.
Yeah.
So if you're one of those guys who really wants to min-max it, I'm not sure if you can remove the cap, but it it runs well. Like, it hits that cap for me, at least.
It seems likely that there is or will be some way.
Oh, yeah.
But I don't know. I haven't... We haven't dived quite that deep into the port, any of us here.
As is the case, this stuff happens in the following, like, week or so after release. We'll definitely write about it if that stuff emerges from the community. Be looking out for it. What else we got, Tom?
Vexily, one of our mods, asks, Tom, when will you get Hellraid, which is a game that got put on hold, I believe. It got put on the back burner, and everyone thought it was canceled. It's kind of like a medieval killing skeletons melee combat game, first person, which got on hold. So I guess we'll get that game when it inevitably comes out, hopefully.
Mm, cool.
Can you please start a weekly Stellaris segment? have either any of you guys played Stellaris? That's the like another space roguelike. We've been getting a lot of space roguelikes, I feel like.
There have been. Yeah.
I haven't played it yet. I've heard of it.
Orion Trail, which is a direct obviously reference to Oregon Trail.
I get it now.
Any opinions on the Deus Ex Mankind Divided pre-order controversy?
It's gross.
I guess we knew this question was coming.
Super dumb. Yeah. This sort of happened while we were at PAX, so I haven't had a chance to dig into the actual details, but any sort of if you bribe us, we'll release the game earlier thing is just totally unprecedented and ridiculous, and we're right to backlash against it.
And beyond that, I mean, that's like the final sort of tier, and they're doing the thing before that where it's like, if we hit this many pre-orders, you'll get this, as if they're really going to withhold things if we don't somehow like prove our commitment, you know, which is really really icky and gross. I don't like the idea of consumers being asked to like prove yourselves by pre-ordering and getting your friends to pre-order, and then I guess maybe you deserve this stuff. It's just
like
that's
a wallpaper.
Really, that's really frustrating. I already don't like pre-orders. I like them a little more now that Steam refunds exist, but that's still not a perfect system. So
yeah, I mean, on the surface, this is kind of their take on stretch goals, right? I guess.
Yeah.
But any sort of building this into pre-orders is just disgusting.
Yeah.
We obviously don't encourage anyone to pre-order anything unless you're fully committed and you've already played all games in the series or whatever. And even then, you're not even anticipating like the technical difficulties that arise on day one.
There are reasons to pre-order, but they are far and few between, basically.
I mean, there are games I would pre-order just because I, you know, if I'm like a super huge fan and I just don't care that it might be broken, you know?
Sure.
But it says something about me to pre-order it. I don't recommend it very often.
The stupid thing people are pointing out about this Deus Ex one, too, is that, like, it essentially means that the internal date for finishing the game is the 4-day earlier date. It has to be. They can't be planning on releasing it on this later date and then suddenly release it earlier unfinished, right? Which means that internally they're planning to release this game 4 days early, and it's like it's like almost threatening to release it late. It's like they're holding the game hostage.
It's also 4 days.
It's 4 days.
I understand being excited about the game, but who cares?
Well, it's their most passionate fans that potentially do not benefit from this weird promotion, which is sad. You know, these are the Deus Ex loyalists, the folks that have been with the series and are most passionate about it, and they're the ones that care the most. Because the guy who, you know, likes the idea of a Deus Ex game or is kind of in the mood for it or just heard something about it and pre-orders it from GameStop or whatever, he's like, okay, whatever. Like, he doesn't care if it's out for it. He doesn't even know if this exists, probably. So,
yeah.
With PC, we have another question. With PC getting a lot of attention lately from the Metal Gear games, do you think we'll ever see an HD collection for Metal Gear on PC, that is? Honestly, I'd just settle for the third and fourth game. Like, I don't even need HD versions. Like, I'd just like all the Metal Gear games to hit PC at some point.
That'd be nice.
It feels up in the air to me. We don't really know what Konami's going to do going forward.
Remasters aren't easy to do. You don't just sort of flip a switch and you have better graphics. I mean, there's like UI scaling to take into account. There's controls. There's just the way things were loaded even, you know, in that old format off, I guess it was CD, DVD. I don't know.
Truthiness FC asks, have you gotten your hands on Active Aggression? Have either of you played that?
Oh, I know Active Aggression. I have not personally played that, no. Sorry.
Wow. Such is life. That's an RTS, though, correct?
Mm-hmm.
It's another entry in the kind of like slowly coming back, like, true RTS game genre, right? Like, they disappeared for a long time in the same way the arena shooter did, and now we're starting to see Grey Goo and other things like that really bring back RTSs.
Yeah, Planetary Annihilation just got basically a big patch refresh that, you know, if you already supported the game, the original Kickstarter, you got for free. It was, I think it's like $13 or $15 on Steam. Added Titans, which are these, like, giant units, so... Yeah, it's hanging around, which is great. StarCraft, of course, Legacy of the Void.
Yeah.
As well.
Well, StarCraft is also just StarCraft 2 in general is like this weird enigma of it has been forever, right? Like it's still going, but it's so, I feel like at least the enthusiasm for people that are not like StarCraft fans already has really diminished. Like there used to be this period where like people would be watching StarCraft 2 even if they didn't play StarCraft 2, and now it's like mostly StarCraft 2 players watch StarCraft 2.
I was one of those people.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, several years ago, I really enjoyed watching StarCraft 2. I wasn't playing it actively. I really enjoyed seeing the top players and appreciating, you know, what is like kind of unprecedented level of skill in any strategy game. I don't think you can even compare it to what people do in League of Legends because you have the whole economy system and whatnot that you have to manage. And yeah, it is kind of a shame that it seems to have dwindled. I mean, I know the Archon mode in Legacy of the Void where you're basically cooperatively controlling one army is an attempt to sort of bridge that gap of, okay, we know StarCraft 2 is a really hard game to manage in terms of the level of input and intention and the camera movement. You have to, you know, not everybody's has a level of time to dedicate to get great at that stuff. So they allow you to sort of have somebody manage the base. You can kind of divvy up how you want. You can be managing different squads and stuff. So that's a really clever way of handling it, I think.
Well, I think that's all the time we have today. Thank you very much, everyone, for watching on Twitch and listening at home, whatever the case may be. I've been Tom Marks here with James Davenport, Tyler Wilde, and Evan Lottie. We will see you live next Tuesday at 1 p.m. Pacific time. Same place, same time, right here at twitch.tv/PCGamer. Thanks very much, and we'll see you next week. Bye, everyone.
Bye.
Bye. Bye. Bye. Giant flaming whale.